Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
After a long career in sales in the Chico area, Scott Huber changed directions in 2008 and began working in outdoor and wildlife fields as a park ranger, field biologist, and wildlife tour guide. To research his latest novel, Beasts of the Border, Scott Huber volunteered as a camera trap monitor along the border wall, identifying images of animals that until recently freely migrated across the U.S.-Mexico border. He also volunteered at a migrant shelter in Douglas, Arizona, where he helped cook meals and distribute clothing to asylum seekers who were legally seeking residence in the United States. Scott Huber's 2023 historical fiction, Yellowstone DNA, is about the wolves of Wyoming Rockies. His latest novel, Beasts of the Border, takes place in the southeast corner of Arizona near his winter residence. Scott Huber, welcome.
Thanks, Nancy. Always a pleasure.
You know, I just was so taken by your cover photograph. My goodness, there's this animal whose eyes are just so penetrating. I'm just haunted by it. And I'm wondering if people, when they see your cover, are saying, Scott, is that a leopard?
Yeah, it's an easy mistake to make. I think we all have grown up associating large spotted felines with leopards. But in fact, our largest North American feline is the jaguar, very similar, with one very distinct difference in that the circular spots on their body are filled with two other spots in the middle of the spot. And those are called rosettes, spotted rosettes. They're sometimes referred to as clouds. But that's the easiest way to tell a leopard from a jaguar.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about a leopard, we talk about a leopard spots. But when we talk about a jaguar, you say rosettes.
Rosette is the best term, yeah.
So why don't you introduce us to this character that we see on the cover by reading a couple of pages from your prologue?
Yeah, I'd be delighted to. The jaguar, Solitario, was hunting almost constantly, putting on weight for the extended journey he was subconsciously preparing for. He was normally somewhat selective in his dietary preferences, but now the massive feline was catching and consuming anything that would build up his energy reserves. Within the last month, he had consumed one or more of each of a laundry list of prey items: peccaries, deer, possum, rabbits, turkeys, turtles, various reptiles, birds, and fish. He had even taken a beef calf that had strayed from a rancho. This would be his third sojourn from his home in the highlands of southern Sonora, Mexico, to the northernmost reaches of his range. Neither of the first two trips had completely fulfilled his goal. While he had located a number of game-rich habitats in the north, he had failed to find a female of his species to mate with. The biological drive to reestablish and expand his species domain led him to wander the more than 300-plus mile route to the Yavapeno Mountains of southeastern Arizona. The previous journeys had not proven particularly dangerous, other than having to avoid the tangle of fencing, bollards, and razor wire cutting across the Parula Mountains at the southern end of the Yavapenos. As the apex predator along his route, he had nothing to fear from other animals. At 175 pounds, he was as heavy as a male jaguar gets in the northern end of their range. Only the local black bears could match his size, and none could match his strength and cunning. His cousin, the puma, was quicker and more agile, but Solitario was stronger and bulkier. Where the ranges of the two big cats overlapped, they chose to largely ignore each other. His only real threat was from humans. Indigenous poachers occasionally shot the imperiled cats for the $50 or more they could get for the beautiful golden brown coats with the black rosettes. while that same pelt would sell for $3,000 to $5,000 or more in Europe or China. It was the uniqueness of the black rosettes, irregular rings of black with an orange center featuring one or two internal black dots, that set them apart from the undotted rosettes of the African leopard pelts that were more common on the black market. Luck had been with him. He'd managed to avoid humans on both of his previous trips and throughout his life. At 8 years of age, he was in his physical prime and was ready to attempt this quest once more. It was winter where he was heading, but by the time he arrived, the days would be warming, and maybe this time he would find what he had been seeking.
This is Scott Huber reading from his latest book, Beasts of the Border, and we meet this beast who is the protagonist. He's a jaguar, solitario. And you say he was putting on weight for the extended journey he was subconsciously preparing for. So that sounds like he's following instinct. It's not a conscious decision that he's making this long journey, but it's his intuition that's telling him, okay, solitario, you've got to head north. And you refer to him as an apex predator. And what do you mean by apex predator?
Well, he's at the top of the food chain. There's nothing else, just like a great white shark would be the apex predator in the ocean. And a grizzly bear would be the apex predator in the northern part of North America. The jaguar is really the apex predator in southern U.S. and Mexico, and all the way down into South America, all the way to Argentina.
And I was surprised at his size, 175 pounds for a cat. That seems like
and
a
that's
lot.
Not even, yeah, that's not even a particularly big jaguar. The jaguars in the northern end of their range here in Sonora, Mexico, don't get as big as the ones in the Amazon, but that get up to about 250 pounds.
And you also give us some rather surprising statistics about why humans were a threat. And I'm assuming that everything you say in that paragraph is true, Scott, about what poachers get?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, if anything, I've understated the value of those pelts. It may very well be that, you know, in the right market, in the right conditions, they could go for tens of thousands of dollars in Europe or China.
Yeah, because you say resell for $3,000 to $5,000 or more in Europe or China, and that's pretty amazing. And you say that indigenous poachers occasionally shot these cats for the $50 or more they could get for the coats. They get $50 and they are sold for thousands outside their country.
Well, you know, I think as often happens, the indigenous people that feed the market are sort of at the bottom of the wage scale. Mm-hmm. I mean, they make the entry level, and then it just every time they trade hands from then on, price goes up and up. So,
yeah, I would expect that, but that's such a huge gap. And so, while we're talking about these countries, say Central America, you have the next. This is still in the prologue now. We next go 1,700 miles south to a small village in Nicaragua. Why did you choose to set part of your book in Nicaragua?
So I wanted to compare and contrast the dispersal and migration of animal species to and across the border, to human migration to and across the border. Central America for many years has been the leading source of migrants heading to and into the U.S. And Nicaragua in particular has an issue of political persecution, which is when you're talking about the issue of asylum. Asylum traditionally has been based, granting of asylum has been based on political persecution. So what I wanted to point out was people that were fleeing actual political persecution, which would qualify them for asylum when they got to this country. Nicaragua would be of the Central America. There's a lot of problems, of course, that people are trying to escape down there, gang violence, drug violence, all sorts of things. But political persecution is one that Nicaragua sort of specializes in these days.
My guest is Scott Huber, and his latest book is one that, Scott, I think this should be better known. You write, the title of your book is Beasts of the Border. We know about humans. I mean, that's daily news here about the humans trying to cross the border. But I don't think anybody's reporting on these animals that want to cross the border is the word, because you were saying that he's just, this character Solitario is following his instincts, my word for it, to cross the border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably a much bigger issue here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Not only because of the jaguars, but Mexican gray wolves, which were recently reintroduced in various places throughout Arizona and New Mexico, also have the problem of having a natural pattern of dispersal on both sides of the border. So now we've cut off, right now there's like 247 Mexican gray wolves in Arizona and New Mexico, and then there's a population of almost the same size, I forget the exact number, in Sonora. And these small populations, when an animal population gets that low, it requires as much interbreeding as possible to avoid the problems of inbreeding. So when you cut off half the population with that wall, you've inhibited the successful breeding of the animals. So it's a big deal here in Arizona. I know it has gotten out on the national news a few times, and there's been a few jaguars that have actually been named and are quite famous. There's one named El Jefe, the boss in English, and he became quite famous in 2016, and then he was relocated again in Mexico. He was found here in the U.S. in Arizona, near Tucson, and then nobody saw him for, I think, 6 years, and then he was caught on a camera trap in Sonora, Mexico, so everybody was happy that El Jefe was still alive.
So one of our protagonists is a jaguar. Now let's meet the human, I almost use the word heroes, characters in your story. Why don't you read us a little bit about this family that is living in Nicaragua?
Sure. The Lopez family, Pedro and Concepcion, and their five children, two of whom are adopted from her sister, are living in squalor in Nicaragua. He's working in a cigar factory. And I'll just read you this passage.
Okay.
On this morning, Pedro was worried. Although Pedro himself avoided political conversation, his brother Juan had been publicly complaining about the lack of government action on wages and human rights. The previous day, Juan had not shown up for work, and his wife said he had not come home that evening. Lately, it was not uncommon for political dissidents to come up missing, and sometimes brothers, sisters, fathers, and mothers mysteriously disappeared as well. Approaching the cigar factory on foot, Pedro's fears were realized. At a distance, he could see, standing just outside the entryway, three wiry men that Pedro recognized as local thugs. The government used these men to intimidate or beat dissenters into submission, or worse. Before he could take cover, the bullies saw Pedro and began to strut towards him. Not knowing what else to do, Pedro instinctively turned and ran. The three men shouted after him, "You'd better run! Run far away! You're done in this town!" Pedro did not stop running until he arrived breathless back at the family's hovel. "Hurry, we have to leave. They're coming for me," Pedro shouted to his wife as he burst in through the doorway.
This is my guest today, Scott Huber. He's reading from his novel, Beasts of the Border. And I even hesitate to call it a novel because the characters are fictional. But you are in a position to know a lot of facts that you include in your book that I think it's very helpful for us to know. So he's telling his family, he goes to his family, says, "We got to leave." And then his family says, "Where should we go?" So we as readers, we don't know where they're going to go. We just know they've got to go. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Scott Huber, and his latest novel is Beasts of the Border. You also include some facts about the country of Nicaragua. For example, a revolution in 1979, and President Daniel Ortega's regime was not the best for the country. But I hadn't realized that it was Nicaragua had the lowest per capita income, lowest adult literacy rate, and the highest infant mortality rate in Central America. And that's all still true, I would imagine.
Yes. And I mean, the bar is very low for Central America. Central America has so many issues. And, you know, I think some people wonder, why are so many Central Americans coming to the U.S.? Well, their conditions down there are absolutely abhorrent. And, you know, my personal belief is that we should be investing in trying to make those countries better if we want to keep those people from trying to get into our country.
So there were just several reasons right there that would be reasons to leave this country, Nicaragua. So there were so many people. You say that the volume of people fleeing Nicaragua had grown to nearly 700,000 people a year, 700,000 a year leaving Nicaragua. And like I say, I think these are statistics that are accurate that you are quoting for us, the readers.
And they're down now. I mean, this was 2 or 3 years ago that was the case. They're down now to about number five. There are plenty of countries that where even more people than 700,000 are coming across. Some of the other, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Venezuela's, of course, been huge and in the news a lot. But all of those countries.
So we meet the Lopez family, who is forced, they had to get out of the country, Nicaragua. Then you introduce us to American characters, and there's a good guy and a bad guy. And I use the term guy, but one of them is a woman. So would you read us and introduce us to Meredith?
Sure. This is under the chapter Two Ranchers.
Chapter three is entitled to Two Ranchers. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Here we go. Meredith grew up around Mexican ranch workers and their families, many of whom became lifelong friends. She spoke fluent Spanish and was empathetic to the plight of many of the border crossers. On the other hand, she was frustrated by the never-ending volume of food wrappers, clothing, and excrement left in the wake of the travelers, not to mention the occasional dead body and frequent sick and injured walkers that showed up at the ranch house door seeking help. She felt strongly that immigration rules must be changed and border security improved, but she did not blame the immigrants for wanting a better life. Marvin, on the other hand, the other rancher, was the fourth Estep male to run the Cochise spread. And given his age and lifelong bachelorhood, he was likely the last. The name Cochise, the once great chief of the Chokanen band of Apache, had been chosen for the ranch because of the role the family had played in helping to exterminate the local Indians who once roamed the area. Marvin's parents had taught him to fear and resent the foreigners trespassing on their land. When Marvin took over the operation of the ranch, he purged any non-Anglos from the ranch staff and spent an inordinate amount of time and money on making the fences surrounding his property as hazardous for migrants as possible. Not only did he loathe the idea of foreigners being provided a path to legal residency, he truly believed that brown-skinned people were an inferior race. On one thing, both ranchers agreed. Both Marvin and Meredith were happy to hear of the federal government's plan to erect what it claimed would be an impervious wall along the border. For Meredith, it might mean a significant reduction in the flow of sick and injured foreigners she felt compelled to care for at the house, and that Mexico instead of the U.S. might find ways to help the indigent. For Marvin, it meant he could spend less time chasing down and badgering illegal trespassers. But while Meredith's hopes were rooted in compassion, Marvin's were based on hatred, to the point of cruelty. While Meredith left water bottles out for dehydrated trekkers, Marvin had been known to take food and water from the travelers he encountered, pouring it out onto the ground or grinding it into the dirt with his boot. In fact, Marvin was an anomaly among the local ranching community. While other borderland ranchers suffered the encroachment in relative silence while working to support laws strengthening border security, Marvin had lately become obsessed with catching and tormenting the encroachers. His hostility had become sadistic. More than once, he had forced migrants at gunpoint to remove their shoes, making them walk barefoot to the rendezvous with Border Patrol agents. Lately, he had developed a fondness for shooting over their heads or to either side of the terrified crossers.
This is my guest, Scott Huber, and he's lived in Chico many years ago, and now he and his wife are coming back to Chico. But, you know, as you read these characters, and I know they're made-up characters, but they represent people who really do exist, and I'm thinking, Scott, Meredith sounds like you. Doesn't she do some of the things that you do when you're in Arizona?
I worked at a migrant shelter for a while. I did only occasionally every Friday last winter. I'd get there in the morning and help prepare soups and cook beans and heat up tortillas and that sort of thing for people that would be dropped off by the Border Patrol mid-morning. We would care for them during the day if they needed clothing, which many of them did because it was winter. We had a stockpile of donated clothing that we would sort of restock them with. And then each of them had a piece of paper in hand with the name and phone number of their U.S. sponsor, who they had made arrangements with beforehand to go to live with until their trial date. Mm-hmm. And then in mid-afternoon, we'd put them on the bus. We'd take them to Tucson, to a sort of a secondary shelter, and some we would drop off at the airport so they could go directly to their sponsors. Yeah, that's what I did.
Well, I was surprised how long it takes for them to get a trial date.
And of course, that system has been dismantled now. Asylum is off the table. Yeah. So that's not happening anymore. But as of last year, their trial dates were, many of the dates that I was seeing on their slips of paper were 3 or 4 days out, or 3 or 4 years.
Years, out. Yeah. Well, if the Lopez family is making this journey from what Meredith is pretty disgusted about or frustrated by all the trash that's along the way, clothes and the occasional dead body, my goodness. So this is not very pleasant, but the Lopez family, this family, the mother and dad and the children, have to feed themselves somehow. How do they do that? And I'm guessing that you base this on what you learned of the people trying to make their way north. How do they feed themselves?
Right. They only grabbed what they had time to grab before they left, which included very little money. So Pedro gets jobs along the way. He gets a job picking coffee cherries for a few days before he's harassed out of that situation.
Well, and maybe you should explain what coffee cherries are. They're not fruit. They're not cherries. They are
what? No, well, they're the pulpy part of the that surrounds the coffee bean. So and they come in all, you know, they span from red to yellow to green depending on their amount of ripeness. They're picked as cherries, and then eventually those hulls are sloughed off or roasted off, and then they become the beans.
So Nicaragua produces coffee as well as tobacco. But now, so this family's traveling along, and Pedro gets a job, but some fellow workers say, Pedro, slow down. Why did they tell him to slow down? He was doing good work. He was getting the job done.
Well, of course, one of the problems with this huge influx of migrants is that the locals are threatened by them. So in Pedro's case, I'm not sure whether he was still in Nicaragua or whether he had crossed over in Guatemala. You know, the people that were already there working on the coffee ranch were feeling threatened by how hard he was working. They were, you know, they'd had these jobs for years and years, and suddenly here comes this, you know, the slang for Nicaraguans is Nicos in Central America. So here comes this Nico, and he's picking 7 lugs of coffee cherries a day. And the locals that have been working there are only picking 5, and he's making them look bad. So they're like, well, let's get rid of this guy because he's going to put our jobs at risk. So they actually harass him off the ranch, and he's back on the family's back on the road, now heading to Honduras or whatever the next country is in line.
You know, something similar a few years ago here in Chico, there was a company that hired an older guy to do some, it wasn't a very high up position, but he did his job so well that he raised the bar for the younger staffers who weren't too happy about it.
Right.
So I could sympathize with Pedro when these guys are saying, hey, Pedro, slow down. And so, but they might take action against him for doing that. So that was another reason for him to be scared. Well, now we come to a couple of characters that are biologists. And who are the biologists in your book?
Sure. There is a pair of biologists. One is sort of a renowned feline biologist. Her name is Ripley West. And her student assistant, Tony. And she has already made a name for herself by being the first U.S. biologist to actually see a live jaguar on the U.S. Many times they're caught on cameras, but they're rarely seen, you know, firsthand. So Ripley is famous for that. And there's a short chapter here that introduces her.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you read a little paragraph about her?
Sure. In 2020, PhD candidate Ripley West had camped out for nearly 60 days near a place called Carbajal Canyon on the west flank of the Carrizaleño Mountains. As a part of the Arizona-New Mexico Jaguar study, her job was to affix camera traps or trail cameras at randomly generated locations along probable animal travel routes.
This is Scott Huber, and he is reading a paragraph from his book, Beasts of the Border, and her job was to affix these camera traps or trail cameras. And we sometimes see video of animals that have been photographed, but you had some actual experience with Well, call them camera traps. I prefer trail cameras. Don't you, Scott, have some experience with that?
Yeah, so my other research project was to volunteer with a group called the Sky Island Alliance. The Sky Island Alliance is a conservation organization that works in the region of these, what they call Sky Island, which are these high mountain ranges that are right near the U.S.-Mexico border. And they're very unique ecosystems in that they go all the way from desert habitat to, the montane habitat, pine trees and conifers at 10,000 feet. So Sky Island Alliance has a program where they monitor trail cameras, I'll use your term, along the border wall, within a half mile of the border wall. And actually they focus some of their trail cameras right on these tiny little wildlife openings that were built into the bottom of the wall. And they capture a lot of really interesting animals, both crossing the border wall and trying unsuccessfully to cross the border wall. So they often get videos of things like black bears that can't make it across. Female mountain lions can with their young, but the male mountain lions cannot. Jaguars cannot fit their heads through these little, what they call wildlife openings, which are really, they're just kind of a joke. No priority was given to the idea of border crossing wildlife, and not enough allowances were made for them to do so successfully.
In fact, the cover of your book, prominent is this cat staring us into our eyes with his, and then behind him is the border wall. I maybe don't know that. Now, you designed this cover yourself, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah, these are bollards, these big square posts that there's a 4-inch gap between them. And they were designed to be impenetrable. In fact, they're not impenetrable to humans. Humans can outsmart them in various ways. But, most animals too large to fit through don't have any way to get through it. There are still sections that are not complete of the border wall. And so some animals have been able to take advantage of that. But for the most part, any animal larger than this 8.5 by 11 square at the bottom of the border wall cannot make it through. But yes, the picture on the cover is my rendition of the border wall bollards with the jaguar solitario pacing along beside the wall.
Well, since we've been talking about the wall, let's hear from your chapter 18. The title is The Wall. So would you tell us a little bit more about what's in your chapter, The Wall?
Yeah, I would say, to me, this chapter is kind of what the book was meant to be about. It was meant to point out this challenge that's presented for wildlife by this wall that was designed to keep out people, but inadvertently, it's keeping the natural paths and traditions of animal dispersal from happening. So just to read you a pretty descriptive part of what happens when a jaguar reaches the wall. Just as he reached the place where his nose told him the dry arroyo would start to become a canyon, there was an obstacle. In the black of the moonless night, he sensed rather than saw the obstruction. Something loomed over him, blocking the stars that peppered the sky. Approaching the barrier cautiously, his nose touched a cold metal post. He licked the steel for the cool metallic taste it provided. He could see now, between the steel bar and the posts on either side of it, a 30-foot-wide stretch of bare gravel in the faint starlight. Beyond the flat gravel, the desert resumed. Looking to his left, then his right, the steel columns continued for as far as he could see. he snarled. Raising his paw and extending his claws, he scraped the square metal bars, seeking a foothold. The smooth columns provided nowhere that his claws could dig in. There was space between the bollards to put his whole front leg through. Reaching a leg between and wrapping it around the post, he attempted to pull on it, as he would a vine hanging down in the jungle. There was no give. These metal vines were not going to be moved. Padding back and forth, his feline brain searched for a solution. Over. Of course, he would jump over it, just as he had most vertical obstacles that he had encountered. From standing still, he first crouched, then wiggled his hindquarters and leapt straight up. At the apex of his leap, he reached out, hoping to find the top, but all that his claws could do was squeal like fingernails on a chalkboard as he slid back down the posts. Undeterred, he backed up 20 feet, and this time took a running leap. The pads of his feet used his momentum to propel him up the bollards. At the top of his leap, he again reached for a foothold. This time, rather than sliding down the columns, he flew backwards, flipping in midair and landing on all 4 feet as a house cat would. Like a sheer, tall cliff, this obstacle was clearly too high for his abilities. Solitario again snarled, then hissed, and struck at the barrier with his claws. A steely clang was the only result. Tilting his face towards the sky, he searched for a scent that might provide him with an answer, but found nothing to guide him in the desert air.
And this is Scott Huber reading from his latest book, Beasts of the Border. And this section was about a beast at the border. And I was wondering, Scott, how you knew to write this, or this is what you would, in your imagination, what would happen when a big cat like this, a 175-pound jaguar, gets to this wall. Was that your imagination, this scene?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I spent quite a bit of time right at the border wall. Here, just about an hour south of me, there is a service road where you can drive right next to the border wall. You can touch the border wall for half an hour. You can see all the few wildlife openings at the bottom. You can see the design of it. You can see the floodgates that are designed to be open in case of flash floods, where arroyos meet the wall. So I had a pretty good sense of what the wall looked like and felt like, and the height of it, and what it was made of. And, I researched the leaping ability of both jaguars and mountain lions. Jaguars, from a standing jump, they can jump 10 vertical feet. A mountain lion can jump 15 to 20. So I tried to imagine what this frustrated animal would do when encountering an obstacle that he didn't know how to get around. And so the rest of it is all imagination.
After a break, Scott Huber and I will be back to continue our conversation about his new novel, Beasts of the Border. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Scott Huber, whose latest novel is Beasts of the Border, and it's about the two types of migrants, humans and animals. Well, you know something that surprised me, this was a much earlier chapter, and you mentioned that jaguars like water. And I had trouble imagining that because their cousins, you mentioned the mountain lion or bobcat, I don't think they like water. So how did
I was actually, I was actually challenged by a biologist on that, a jaguar biologist. She said, I don't know that I would say that they like water, but they are very accustomed to crossing water and don't show any hesitation to do that. So does that mean they like water? I don't know. But they spend a lot of time. They spend a lot of time in it.
I would say they're willing to get in the water. Maybe that's more.
If you Google mountain lion, or not sorry, jaguar hunting videos, what you'll find is a lot of videos of jaguars diving into rivers in the Amazon basin, capturing caimans and giant river otters. And
you mean a turtle sometime. One time, Solitario grabbed the turtle.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. They're great at cracking turtle shells. You know, like a lot of big predators, the skull is the easiest place to for a kill shot on whatever it is you're getting. And so they have this, I think, 600 pounds of pressure that they in their jaws. So it's real easy for them to crack right through a turtle shell or a skull or whatever.
Well, one thing, too, you mentioned in your book that this was a 2,300-mile journey that would take them between 3 and 7 days. So I looked up on a map to see, okay, here's Nicaragua and here's, say, Arizona. And I thought, gosh, that's a long way. I don't see how they could do that in 3 to 7 days. Well, I guess I could see maybe 7 days, but a 2,300-mile journey that these migrants make. And I assume that's an actual statistic that you are giving us.
Well, I think depending on how they get here, it can take months. But if they do what the majority of the migrants do, which is hop on the train known as the train of death or the beast, La Bestia.
Yeah, that's one of your chapters.
It, it can take them as little as 3 to 5 days to get all the way from the Guatemala-Mexico border to the U.S. border. And it's a grueling trip. It's all you're, for the most part, unless you're super lucky, you're sitting outside, either on the little platforms between cars or on top of the cars. You're completely exposed to the weather. You are, the length of time between stops can make it impossible to, relieve yourself, to get food, etc. There's actually volunteer checkpoints along the tracks that hand out food, hot food, to people that ride the train. And it's a fascinating, this whole concept of these people riding the trains is fascinating. And sometimes you see 1,000 people riding on one train.
Yeah, you mentioned on back cover, along this migrant trail, this family encounters unimaginable obstacles and hardships. And we haven't even told some, we're just touching the surface of what's going on in your book with this Lopez family. And I would like to give a little bit of a shout out to one of the good guys. We mentioned Meredith was a good guy, and as opposed to Marvin, who was not, these two ranchers. But there was also a friend and champion whose name was Alejandro, and they called him Jandro. And I think listeners would really like to read what happens to this friend and champion, Alejandro. And we haven't even talked about him. So I don't want
to. And then there's the Border Patrol agents. And oh, the
yeah.
drug runners.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't talked about them.
I know. Well, we just have to leave some surprises for the readers. And Scott, you're going to be coming back to Chico shortly. And I'm guessing maybe you're working on another book.
I've got a couple that I'm a part of the way into. But the one that I really want to write, I haven't started yet, which is about the extinct birds and the extinct cultures of Hawaii.
In fact, I didn't even mention your interest in that. That's another interest of yours that you mention in your book, that you are an avid birder and you volunteer with organizations that monitors wildlife detections at the border wall. That we read in your book. But you also are an avid birder. So we will look forward to hearing from your next book, and you'll be writing that here in Chico. Yes?
Hopefully, yeah. I haven't started it yet, so.
Well, we will look forward to that. And again, thank you for bringing awareness to this problem, the consequences of building a wall, a physical wall, that prevents animals from doing what's in their very nature. So thank you for writing this book, Scott.
Thank you, Nancy. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
Eric Miller is a freelance writer based in Chico. His work has appeared in newspapers, magazines, and his Etc. Guy blog, where he writes about family life. And locally, his work has appeared in the Chico Enterprise Record, the Chico News and Review, and Growing Up Chico magazine. And Eric Miller has some commentary for us today. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you for having me. This is great. So this is a story I wrote based on an experience I had in the summer of 2024 in Tahoe National Forest. I was on a hiking training mission with a good friend of mine. We had never camped together, and the name of this story is Subaru Outback is Not Bear Proof. The Subaru Outback is not a bear box. Consumer Reports praises the Outback's strong safety ratings, but when it comes to protecting bagels, cream cheese, and lox from bears, I couldn't find a ranking. I recently adventured with Chili, who shares my passion for the outdoors. She and I have experience in bear country, but this was our first time camping together. "Let's hike Skeleton Mountain," I said. "We can camp nearby. I'll bring my teardrop trailer. It's easy to set up. Then we can hit the trail early." Chili smiled. "I'll bring my tent." "What if a bear visits you?" I asked. "I'd feel bad telling a reporter I slept safe inside a trailer while you were eaten alive. You take the trailer, I'll take the tent. Chivalry isn't dead." "Nope," she grinned. "I love my tent. After I decorate, it becomes my space. I'm not afraid of a stinking bear." Chili had a good point. She has a cool tent. So much for my chivalry. We arrived at the campground, which sits along a creek. Our site was nestled among hardwood and pine trees. The camp host mentioned recent bear activity. "Follow clean camp etiquette," he advised. I unhitched the trailer while Chili pitched her tent. Her temporary home took shape. "Is that a Beyoncé poster?" I asked. "And a unicorn pinata?" Chili hammered the tent stakes. "Can you hand me that shiny thing?" "A beer tab? No, it's part of my disco ball." With camp set up, we hiked to the creek. Two free-range kindergartners, a brother and sister, appeared at our site when we returned. The boy peeled a matted marshmallow from his elbow. Melted chocolate ringed his lips. The girl chatted rapid fire, gulping air between sentences. "He ate 5 s'mores. 5. I ate 4. The kid scampered away on a sugar high through a cloud of graham cracker dust. After a taco dinner, we wiped the table. "Keep a clean camp," I muttered out loud. Chili grinned. "There's more salsa and guacamole. Tomorrow's breakfast is bagels, cream cheese, and lox." Chili packed the leftovers in her wheel tote cooler, which was too large for the bear box. "It's all right," I said. "We'll cinch it tight and stash it inside my car. I've done that before. But our neighbors, those kids, are bear magnets. Let's keep our camp cleaner than theirs." Chili and I talked several hours before turning in for the night. "If you're scared of bears, meet me in the trailer," I teased. Her eyes rolled. "Yeah, right." I scanned the evening sky. Stars glimmered, but I couldn't see the forest silhouette. Upon lying down, I drifted into a restless sleep. Then, bam, a crash jolted me awake. Chili, are you all right? Her flashlight flickered. No, I'm coming in. I opened the door and she jumped inside, shaking like a leaf. I wrapped my arms around her in a bear hug, a peculiar irony since a real bear lumbered just outside. Every cracked twig generated suspense. My mind raced. Where is that bear? We awoke before sunrise, groggy and exhausted. A light wind wafted through the campground. Outside my car, we found shattered auto glass and food scattered about. Chili's tent was untouched. The Beyoncé poster remained intact. The piñata and disco ball turned in the breeze. The bear broke a rear window, wedged the cooler in the window frame, and ripped off the lid. The animal then scooped out bagels, cream cheese, and salmon. Salsa and guacamole globs inside the car resembled an abstract platter painting. The Outback smelled like a Mexican restaurant. We cleaned the car as best we could and informed the camp host. We actually have two bears, he said. They visited us last night, too. He trimmed a piece of cardboard and fastened it over the missing window with duct tape, and on the cardboard we taped the Beyoncé poster. Bear encounters are rare, but the more time you spend in their world, the greater the chance of an incident. Bears hunt for salmon. They might let a few fish go. But in our case, when it came to bagels, cream cheese, and salmon lox, it wasn't catch and release. In the matter of Subaru Outback versus Animal Kingdom, score one for the bear. This is Eric Miller.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
You've loved too many Geminis, the psychic tells me. Can't trust a word they say. They're evil twins who live to get their way. I'm watching her mouth, her lipstick smeared above the lip line. You're wrong, I tell her. I've only loved one Gemini. What kind of psychic are you? I feel it, she says. I see Geminis floating around you, heating up the air you breathe, permeating every cell. I can smell them all over you, a halo of twins pulling you apart. Look, I tell her, you're a fake psychic. A psychic who needs her eyes checked. And then I left to visit someone else who thinks he knows the real me. Kim Dower.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.